Hi, Sunstone listeners. This is Lindsay Anson Park, and I'm giving you an intro because we're doing something different today. If you've been following my Facebook, which is really the only social media that I engage in these days, I'm just really not a fan of social media. You'll know that Brian and I tried something new. We did an actual video recording of ourselves. Brian and I don't like being on video. I know that's a weird thing to say for someone who's like me, who's on camera and documentaries, but I really don't like it as much as I probably should. It's hard to be on video. It's uncomfortable. It's awkward for both of us. At the end of the day, we're both awkward people. And we just really like the history. We want to hide behind our microphones and talk about the history. That's what we're most interested in. But we understand that the world is changing and we're trying to adapt to that. So we are occasionally releasing videos for the podcast, and they're not always going to be the same. Today it is. Today is the audio of the video that Brian and I did. So you can get it here, kind of check it out, see if you want to watch it. If you do want to watch it, I'll throw the links in to the podcast notes, but you can go to our Sunstone Foundation YouTube channel and subscribe. We've had it for years. We haven't really done anything with it. We don't have very many subscribers. It's not something we have spent a lot of time doing. Again, Sunstone is a shoestring operation. We have a very small staff. There's three of us, but we put on this big symposium every year. So I think people think that we're bigger than we are. We just work day in, day out to preserve these stories of Mormon history, to preserve the history, to preserve an archive that is now reaching 50 years old. Sunstone is almost 50 years old. And when I inherited it, I decided to continue the responsibility of preserving this archive of incredible voices. Any Mormon scholar or historian worth their salt has passed through its doors at some point, has read its articles, has relied on the scholarship there. So it's a really important legacy that we're trying to keep up. But we're a small nonprofit, so that's why we're always hustling, asking for donations. This year, our big initiative is to get recurring donors. You can help if you're listening and you have a few bucks to spare every month. It doesn't have to be a lot. It can be a dollar. It can be $5. It can be more than that. We would love it if it was more than that. But every little bit helps. We have a goal to get a bunch of recurring donors for Sunstone to help pay for this stuff. Now that we're doing YouTube, to get the quality up, it's going to take some work. It's going to take some extra effort, extra equipment, extra technology. So I don't like asking for money. It's irritating. It's not what you want to hear when you're tuning in on the podcast, but that's what we need. That's the reality of the world that we're living in. And in a Mormon community, we're so used to doing everything for free, but the realities of our lives are we need your help and support to keep this going. So if you can, please go to sunstone.org, go to our donate link and become a recurring donor. It doesn't have to be very much, but that would really help us meet our goals and help keep the podcast alive. Today, you're going to hear audio from a video that Brian and I did. Again, I'm going to link that so you might prefer to watch the video, but we're going to give you a taste of this. We're going to do this twice. We're also going to do a video of us coming up with Christina Rossetti about her book with Joseph Musser. So that will be in our next episode. And we'll also have a video for that. But then what we decided to do is we're just going to keep going. We're going to do our history audio here. And then when Brian and I have a lot of historical topics that maybe don't go in chronological order, which is a lot of stuff, or if there's something sort of topical or timely, or we want to have a discussion that where we don't have a script, where we don't have to cite all of our sources, we're going to do video. So you can have both. So check us out at both. Sometimes there will be crossover like there is today. But for the most part, we're trying to give you the best historical content as possible. So with our audio, we like to keep it scripted so we don't mess up our facts. But today's interview is going to talk about that. We're going to talk about kind of sources, the importance of sources and why they matter. And so you'll get to hear that discussion. And again, go over to Sunstone Foundation YouTube channel and subscribe. Follow us there, because apparently all you kids today, you all like your YouTube. So we're going to try that out as well. Just a personal note that I want to thank you for supporting us. We've had overwhelming response to this podcast. We know that it's become a sort of standard for Mormon history, good Mormon history in the podcast field. I'm really proud of that. That was our goal. I'm really lucky to work with someone like Brian who really knows his stuff and has access to such great scholarship like I do at Sunstone. And so we make a unique team. I think we're one of the few podcasts, if only podcasts, that cover the discursive history of Mormonism, the good, the bad, and the ugly, without trying to make any sort of slant on it other than making it entertaining while using some of the best sources, the most up-to-date sources possible. The response has been phenomenal. We hit 4 million listens and streams last year alone for the podcast, which is incredible for like a niche history podcast. So I'm feeling really good about it. Less good about YouTube. It's hard. It's hard to watch yourself. Even when I do Zoom calls with my staff or whatever, I don't like the video on. I've got some issues. I've got some body dysmorphia issues. I don't like watching myself on screen. And Brian just is a Luddite. So between the two of us, it's going to be an awkward thing. I hope you enjoy the awkward show. It wasn't so bad. It was actually fine. We did just fine on the video. But anyway, we love you guys. We really do. Like, we're just enjoying the feedback we get. We enjoy the reviews we get. Please leave us more on iTunes. I feel like with as many streams and downloads that we have, it should reflect that many reviews. And we don't have that many reviews on iTunes. So like, go give us a shout out. It's a little bit of work, but like, come on, guys. If you're like me, if you grew up like me, you can work, right? Like we grew up in a community that like put all our children into the fields until they were of age to have their own fields to force their own children in. So like, put in a little effort. You know, get that beehive spirit, go become a recurring donor, and go subscribe to our YouTube channel, and go leave us a good, review on iTunes. That's the holy trinity of being a good podcast ally and helping this history stay out there for generations. And what's really fun about this podcast is we have a lot of non-Mormon listeners now too, but we have so many faithful Mormons who are dipping their toes in the waters with this history. Thank you for trusting us. I know I get a little salty about your guy, Brigham Young, sometimes, and that's just how it goes. But we love you. We love those people, especially those people who've been following me and supporting me throughout my podcast career, which is 10 years now, you guys. I've been doing this with Year of Polygamy since 2014. That is a long time to be podcasting about Mormon history. It's a cry for help. If anything, your recurring donations can help pay for therapy. I'm mostly kidding. I love this stuff. I eat, drink, and breathe Mormon history. I always have my whole life, ever since my mom used to take me to local elementary schools to talk about the history of pioneers in Utah, dressed as a pioneer. Totally regular upbringing. And now look at me. I'm still doing it. So you all make that possible. We love you. We love hearing your fun emails. We love hearing about your family history. Sorry that we can't respond back to everybody. We really do try, but you know, it's a good time to be doing Mormon history publicly like this. So again, I'll stop talking your ear off. We'll talk your ear off in a different interview with Brian and I. And again, love, love, love you guys. I hope wherever you're hearing this from today, I'm sending you all the good luck, energy, and love in my heart and gratitude for allowing us to do this. It feels really special. So with that, the interview that also has a video on YouTube. I bit
the hand from which I... Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young, that only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
All right. Hi, everybody. It is Lindsay Anson Park and
Brian D. Cannon.
We're from the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast. We're doing something weird and new today. We are doing a YouTube video. We usually hide behind the screens, so you can't.
This is scary.
This is scary. We actually don't. We both don't like being on camera very much.
No.
But we're doing it for you because some people said we were disembodied voices, and we wanted to show that
they weren't
in fact,
wrong. I mean,
we do have mortal tabernacles. See? Right here. So we're going to do this every once in a while when we want to have a conversation about nerdy Mormon things in Mormon history, stuff that most people don't care about, but we care about. And we're going to hope to get you to care about it too. What are we talking about today?
So we're going to talk about, we're going to title this The State of the Sources. We did a roundtable a little while ago with two of our friends, Ben Park and Imagine Hendrix Komodo. Oh, and Micah Chang too from Montana. And so we wanted to go back to one of the things that we talked about that a couple of people had questions about. What kind of sources are out there, particularly digital sources these days?
And let's explain why we want to talk about sources. We talked about this in the episode that Brian just mentioned, and we're going to put that audio up here on this YouTube channel. We're going to, like I said, we're not going to do a real consistent thing with videos, but sometimes we're just going to put this out there. You might listen, you might not. But sources are important, and we have a lot of non-Mormons who listen to our podcast, a lot of historians, which is kind of fun. Hello out there. And I think it's hard for them to kind of understand why Mormons or those talking about Mormon history are so funny about sources. It's because the stakes are really high in our community. And when I first started out as an untrained, just like amateur, talking about polygamy on Year of Polygamy, I didn't know anything about history. I didn't know anything about academia. I didn't know anything other than I had grown up hearing and telling pioneer stories over and over and over. But it became very clear to me in the online spaces that when you talked about history, the sources that you used were really important. And from where I was positioning at the time with Year of Polygamy, if I didn't want to use any source that was considered critical of the church or anti-Mormon, because as a Mormon, you grow up learning that you should not trust anti-Mormon sources. So I really tried to do a history about that. And that's all I knew about sources, that there were good sources and bad sources. And the good sources were the faithful ones, meaning loyal to the church. And the bad sources were the ones that were anti-Mormon or angry or against the church. And, you know, I've come a long way since then and learned a lot about that. But there's still a huge belief about faith politics and source material. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
And that's gotten, if anything, more complicated just simply because we have more sources than we've ever had. So if you go back in the Camelot years and you think about the sources that your average person had ready access to, minimal compared to today.
And that's like 1970s.
Yeah, not that long ago. I mean, practically within our lifetime. So the amount of sources that are available has just exploded. And with that has come new discussions and new things to, and new ways to think about these sources and even rethinking some of the old sources.
And I think there's also this interesting thing happening writ large right now, which is as we're learning more about technology and social media and algorithms and how we sort of get stuck and like siloed into what we believe and know with the emergence of AI and, you know, a lot more digitized sources, there is a struggle for anyone to know what is true and what is not true. And we've seen this happen many times. People have cited us and then sort of misrepresented, not on purpose, but usually through bad interpretation or maybe sort of sloppy interpretation, put, you know, a truncated version of what we do in our podcast out on TikTok. And then it gets sort of recycled as truth. And even the podcast medium is not exempt from it. We don't have a peer review. It's Brian and I going over this, and we've caught ourselves making mistakes in real time. Thank goodness this man has such good recall. But I was listening to an old episode about Sam Brannan, and this is a good example. Sam Brannan gets to California almost a year before the Mormons get to Salt Lake. And in the podcast, I say almost a month before. We don't catch it. So it's tricky. Like, even the way that we're communicating history, which I would say most people now go to Mormon history with podcasts. Hopefully they're reading books.
Let's hope so. I know a good place to get some if you're not.
For those who are new joining us, Brian works at Benchmark Books, and it's been around for how long?
We've been around for 37 years.
What have you learned about sources working at Benchmark?
Well, I'm kind of a weird person because I do love digital sources too. Now, let me be careful. I was down in my basement today trying to wrangle my physical books because they're everywhere. But I love digital sources too. I really love both worlds. But in watching how tastes have changed over the years, Mormon books, especially Mormon history, are much less likely than your average book to have ebooks and especially audiobooks. And with so many people, that's the only way they will consume books. It makes for a different playing field.
Well, and books, okay, so books are sort of like the Bible in documentary history, peer-reviewed history. People will go to what's in the text and say, if it's written down, especially if it's peer-reviewed and cited, then it's true. But we even know that sometimes that's not true. We found mistakes. And so the reason why we even want to have this conversation at all is the truth, as far as we can get it, with the documents and the history is really important to us. I joke that Mormon history is kind of a cult. And it is with this exact obedience, because we want to get stuff right and sources are complicated and the stakes are really high for our community. A lot of people will listen to these podcasts and make decisions about their lives because the history can be used to prove up on or disprove truth claims in Mormonism. And so the stakes are really high. And so we want you to know what were, you know, the limitations of sources, the sort of best practices with sources, so you can make decisions about the history, so you can keep people like us in check, so you can hear something really cool on TikTok and be a little curious and be like, is that true? How are they using their sources? What sources are they using from? I think that's the best we can do as humans in a really confusing time about what is true and what is not true and how we get our information, and to use the technology to be as beneficial as possible. So at least that's my goal.
So what we wanted to do is talk about some of the major repositories where physical sources are, but then also talk about initiatives to digitize those sources. And so let's start with easily the largest single collection of Mormon records is at the Church History Library in Salt Lake City here. And over the years, it grew from being sort of an afterthought in Brigham Young's time to today, where it's in its own huge, state-of-the-art, fantastic facility.
Can you give us like a short version of how the church's history department even started and how it got from then till now?
Sure. So the beginnings come during Joseph Smith's Nauvoo, really. That's where the first time where you have sort of an industry there. So you've got scribes, you've got your guys like Willard Richards, people like William Clayton, people who are there, and there's the first successful effort to compile Joseph Smith's history. And they're kind of in an office there, mainly in the store there. And then, obviously, they leave. Just as they're kind of getting the hang of how to compile history, it's time to go. And then things are boxed away forever until finally they unbox them in Utah, only to box them back up with the Utah War. And then they start again. And so through the end of Brigham Young's time, we see that the historian's office arises and becomes a thing where you have a regular staff there who have assigned tasks, and it starts to look like an actual office as opposed to this kind of ragtag crew. And it's more or less like that until after the turn of the century and even beyond, when it's an in-house faithful project, very insular. And the idea of outside scholars coming in to do research is just completely foreign. That's just not a thing yet.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because I remember, again, I'm going to go back to, you know, my own journey when I was starting out and, you know, figuring out what sources were and like how they were used and how to even do this craft. And I remember there was a lot of discussion about the vaults and the church hiding history and covering it up, because we're going to talk about this. They have destroyed history. They have altered documents. They have been very selective in who they've let see things from time to time. But it's not always for the reasons people think it is. And for example, this idea of letting outsiders to their history is a little bit more complicated than a straight up motive of like, we want to lie to the people. Part of it has to do with a lot of the people that are recording this history, being scribes, for example, writing stuff down or working for the church as historians, really believe in the sacred nature of some of the stuff that they're talking about. And there's this always been this struggle in Mormonism of sacred versus secret. And it's, of course, used as a weapon a lot to hide stuff. But we always kind of get a little like funny when people are like, they're hiding all this stuff and it's in the vaults. And I don't think you realize how incompetent a lot of these early Mormon guys were at being historians. They didn't have scientific history or university classically trained historical degrees to like tell them how to archive stuff.
Yeah, you've got a lot of things going on. One of those is that the field of history generally looks very different at that point. It does not look like our modern, more analytical history. The footnotes and sources and how we think about sources, that has evolved and matured greatly. So that's part of it. The other part.
Finish.
I was going to say too. Part of it too is you have to remember in a pre-plane era, if you're doing research on a topic either specifically Mormon or that involves Mormon, you would have to get here to Salt Lake. I mean, there's just not a lot of people coming to Salt Lake City to do research. And there are a few major attempts, like when H.H. Bancroft does his History of Utah. He corresponds with Mormon leaders, and they actually are pretty free with sources. And they look things over, they write things, they copy things and send them to him. So that was kind of the first main time I can think of when a non-Mormon writer wants to use Mormon sources here in Salt Lake.
And I think about this idea of hiding history. Some people might say I'm an apologist for what I'm about to say, but there's a lot of critique that the church has hidden a lot of history, but no one ever pays attention to how much history the church has allowed. They wrote down all of this stuff. Some of the most controversial stuff in Mormon history was recorded by Mormon sources, like scribes of prophets, for example. So yes, while there has been some, like, it's kind of a spectrum from outright like hiding and obfuscating the history and manipulating the history to just sloppy archive practices, there's also been an attempt to like record things a lot. And we can talk about that too, but I think that that's good to remember that this is, it's not as simple as everything is as like bad guys and good guys. And it changes, like you said, with the tastes and how things go. Can we talk about the thing you showed me in your bookstore the other day about that, where we see them editing history in real time?
Yes.
Is that something we can talk about publicly?
That's very fun. So there are one of the earliest attempts actually to document history is Lucy Mack's history. So after Joseph Smith is killed, she sits down with the Corys there in Nauvoo, Martha Jane and Howard, and dictates a series of memoirs about particularly early Mormon events that to this day are often the only source we have for something. And then it sits just in manuscript form until Orson Pratt gets the manuscript. There's a few stories about how that happens. But what is known is that he takes it to England on his way there and has it published in 1853. And then you fast forward about a decade, and all of a sudden, Brigham Young is now furious about it, out of nowhere. He's in Wellsville, he's at the stake president's house, he sees a copy of the published book there, and loses it. And as you know with Brigham Young, if he lost his mind about something, it would appear in a sermon. So he went off on it. He couldn't believe that a stake president would have such a book. This is, of course, an apostle who has published it. He's really said nothing about it so far. He would claim that Orson Pratt published it without his knowledge. That's not true. Orson told him he was going to do it. That's conveniently forgotten. So his approach is, we are going to bring all your books in, we'll give you tithing credit, we're going to destroy them, and then we're going to publish a revised, corrected history. And so there is an attempt to do that. And there was basically a committee that was formed to do that. and there were copies given to the members of the committee that were then marked up with their changes. And in most cases, they're, you know, just usual typo kind of things. The substantive ones really aren't that huge. He was definitely mad about how William Smith was portrayed there. If you remember back to our succession episodes, William Smith is sort of a candidate to succeed Joseph Smith. Not a very good one, not a very strong one. But by this point, he's, of course, the last surviving Smith brother. And so he's somewhat of a danger to Brigham Young. And so that was one thing he was specifically mad about, was how positively William was portrayed. And so there's this plan to revise the history and then publish a corrected version. Never happens.
Yeah, let me just say this one thing about it. So Brigham Young had a very differing perspective from Joseph Smith's mother, Lucy Mack Smith, about how the history went down. Because Lucy Mack Smith tells the story as Mormonism is a Smith enterprise. It's a family business. And of course, Brigham Young isn't part of that family. And so there are reasons why Brigham Young was offended at this telling. It threatened his power and his authority. And so the narrative is that he edited and changed the history, which he did. But fast forward to what we got to see in Benchmark Books the other day. It was really cool. We got to see some of this editing and how they were doing it in real time.
And that's interesting because you can see at that point the historian's office actually working on publishing history. And that's something that we have to remember too, is throughout the 19th century, when you say history, what do you mean? Do you mean the documentary record that you're preserving and archiving? Or do you mean interpretive history, where you're taking that documentary record and now interpreting it for the reading public? For most of the 19th century, it's the former. It's where we're archiving the documents, not necessarily publishing it. So there had been, obviously, this effort to compile and then publish Joseph Smith's history. And we know that. That becomes History of the Church later. But what I think a lot of people don't realize is that same exact project, the same kind of method, continued all the way up until, I think, 1880. There are these giant ledgers with this continuous narrative history that was compiled from these same kind of documents. Journals, letters, minutes, that kind of thing. But they don't publish that part. And so you can see that even if they're not necessarily articulating it, there are differing opinions on what history means. Is it option A of just preserving documents, or is it option B of actually writing and publishing history that interprets that story?
So tell everyone what we got to look at, and then I'll give my opinion on what it was to look at that in the office. Because Benchmark Books, lots of cool stuff. They get a lot of really rare documents, and sometimes Brian lets me see those. So we got to look at a really fun copy of this history last week.
And it was interesting because you can see several different handwriting, several different samples of handwriting in it. Peter Crowley, who has done more work on Mormon publishing than anyone, has talked about this in his bibliographies of things that you know, it was this conscious, concerted effort to revise it, but that just went nowhere. It's not until 1902 that a revised history finally is published.
So we got to see a copy of this original history. It was passed through several people. Bathsheba Smith, George A. Smith was one of them. And we got to see their notes in the margins of what they wanted to correct. And it was so fascinating. I really hope someone does a better analysis on this eventually. But some of it, you know, it really sort of dispels the myth that they were deliberately trying to hide history. I mean, sometimes they thought maybe Lucy Mack got a name wrong and that they remembered someone being a different age, things like that. There was a lot of that kind of notation. Every once in a while, there was something about William Smith crossed out. And that's where you're like, okay, that's where they're manipulating the history. So it's tricky because you hear something like that and then you want to throw out the whole thing. And this is the scourge of all Mormon history. You hear that there's one flaw in it, and then you think, I don't have to listen to it. The reality is, it's sort of a living organism. It's always shifting and changing. And a lot of the histories that you're reading and you're, you know, making these decisions on have some problems with it. There's no pure history.
And if the Lucy Mack story of her history sounds interesting to you, and it should, our dear departed friend Lavinia Fielding Anderson published a critical edition of Lucy's history. So taking it from the manuscript all the way up through the current version that you can buy still at Deseret Book. So That's a fascinating story, both the what's in the text, but the text itself, how it evolved over the years. It's fascinating. There is an essay at the beginning that's the textual history of it that I think is one of the most interesting things you will ever read from a nerdy standpoint, that is.
Yeah, I second Levina's work. Well, back to the Church History Library. So that's just an example of what we just talked about, of how the church has sort of manipulated the history. Give me one of, in your mind, one of the worst examples of the church history department hiding the history. I always go to Joseph Fielding Smith.
Yeah, he's a tough one, partially because no one's done any good work on him yet. That's, we need more on him, and there's light at the end of that tunnel. Matt Bowman is going to be publishing a concise biography of him in, I believe, the fall through University of Illinois Press that I think will be really good. And then I know our friend Gary Bergera has done a lot of work with Joseph Fielding Smith. Our friend Matt Harris has done a lot of work with him. He is interesting because he clearly, for him, history is mostly that option A, mostly the preserving side of it. He does write history, but it's not good history. In 1922, he publishes a book called Essentials in Church History that's then used as a textbook and will be in print for more than 50 years and will be read by several generations of Mormons. And it's a problematic history. We did a mini-series, Deseret Drama Season 2, where we talked about the history of Mormon history. And we did sort of a compare and contrast between him and B.H. Roberts. And we compared their options on several different things.
And you can find that at sunstone.org, Deseret Dramas. What's the title? We'll link it. It's been a while since we've done it.
I don't remember if we acted. Did we give a title?
I don't know if we did. I think the history of Mormon history.
That could be it. It was a lot of fun. It's a 6-part episode. It's a really good companion to this discussion, I think. So Joseph Fielding Smith is interesting. There are a couple stories that you may have heard of. The one is that Joseph Smith's earliest attempt at writing his own history, his 1832 history, was taken out of a ledger. Now, this is where it gets complicated, because do we know Joseph Fielding Smith did that? We don't. He was the church historian at that time. It's probably likely that he did. But then it does not see the light of day for quite some time. So, and there are other things. He had his own personal safe that occasionally he would see things that he felt were not for public consumption, and he would squirrel them away in his safe. That part is undeniable. The other part of it, too, is during his time as church historian, we do start to see more non-Mormon scholars and Mormon scholars wanting to now publish more history, not just the archiving of records, but actually interpreting that record. And sometimes some help is given, but other times it is not. Fawn Brody, of course, was not given the access that she wanted. Juanita Brooks was not given the access that she wanted. So there are, and there are just fascinating stories of Hugh Nibley and an assistant translating their notes into Spanish and then transliterating that into Greek, because your notes would be looked over by staff there. Joseph Fielding Smith or his assistant, A. Will Lund, who would look over your notes, and if they saw something they didn't like, they might confiscate it. And so people would put stuff in their shoe. They would do things like this because the access level was not quite where it would be if in just kind of a traditional archive.
Yeah, and there's also this weird insider thing that's going on with how they edit the things that they do think is fit for public consumption. For example, things like second anointings are usually redacted out of anything that's digitized in public. That's kind of where the church hierarchy right now, they're protecting that history, not to hide it. I think it's a sacred ordinance, and it's a controversial ordinance because it's exclusive and only given to some people. So it makes sense why they'd want to redact that out. I don't agree with redacting, but that's why they're doing that. With Juanita Brooks, for example, when they were not letting her have access to some documents about Mountain Meadows Massacre, it's complicated. There's this sensibility, and I saw this in Juanita, and I talk about it in the book that the forthcoming biography that I've written about her, where Juanita was for transparency. She wanted these documents. But when she was transcribing diaries, if she saw anything that was about sexual abuse or personal sex lives, she redacted it because for her, that made her uncomfortable. And so it shows her sensibilities at the time. She thought that that was inappropriate for a public record or for a family history. And so I think that there was probably more of that going on than anything. People thought it wasn't relevant to the history or it was too sensitive, and it wasn't trying to hide it necessarily, but it was just such an uncomfortable subject. And I think that church leaders were also guilty of that. If it was something that they didn't know what to do with, they usually just didn't put it out for public consumption. It wasn't worth the bother.
So let's talk now about some of these repositories and what kind of stuff they have. So of course, like we said, Church History Library, by far the biggest holdings of any. And they have an online catalog. And what's so cool is recently they have been digitizing unbelievable amounts of stuff. And this one is kind of an interesting one for me because we'll hear things like they're hiding history, there's no access, and not always, but most of the time, people saying stuff like that, I always want to say, have you actually looked what's available? Because I bet you haven't. There are hundreds of thousands of scan pages of things there. Unbelievable stuff. Stuff that, and part of that dovetails with the Joseph Smith Papers Project, but like the Council of 50 Minutes, things that previous generations of scholars would have given their right arm to see are now digitized. The Nauvoo Era Relief Society minutes, all these incredible resources that are now available. Now, having said that, the 20th century is where a lot of that kind of comes to a screeching halt. We've seen some interesting developments like the Spencer Kimball journals that were just digitized. Redacted, unfortunately, but...
And why? What did they redact?
So the Church History Library, their policy is, the shorthand is SPC. So they will redact things that are sacred, they will redact things that are private, they will redact things that are confidential. And what those actually mean in practice is sometimes a little loosey-goosey, but that's kind of their rubric for what to redact.
And again, before we get accused of being apologists for the Church History Department, we have talked about the whole scandal of William Clayton's diaries on our podcast, the Censored Mormon History Podcast. We did, I think it's 3 episodes on the William Clayton journals, which is an example of when the church was trying to keep stuff away from the public. So there are instances of it, but like you said, it's more complicated as to what the motives are behind it.
So we've got the Kimball journals, and another really interesting one that's in process right now are the George F. Richards journals. So he was an apostle, but also interestingly, the president of the Salt Lake Temple for a time, and then basically the head of temple correlation, you might say. And so his will be a fascinating case study when those are finally completed to see how much was redacted. We had a really interesting, unexpected window into that when the George Q. Cannon journals were published online because someone apparently accidentally hit publish just a little too soon.
That was an exciting day for all the Mormon history nerds out there.
There was a very fun Sunstone presentation from several of our friends where they talked about the idea of redaction and censorship and how that plays out. And the Canon journals were an example of that that they talked about. So Church History Library, amazing things there. And if you go in their catalog, you can see what's there and what's digitized and what's not. And that's kind of fun because it's Mormon history, but it's frequently family history. I've had multiple people come in the store that are asking about their ancestor and what's out there. I'm like, well, have you checked the catalog? No. So that's kind of fun because they may have your ancestors' journals and correspondence that might already be digitized or they might digitize for you. So Church History Library, lots of interesting things there. BYU has an amazing archive as well, and they have also started to digitize things. University of Utah, kind of similar. But things like the Juanita Brooks papers have been digitized.
Oh, I am a huge fan, obviously, of the Use Archives because it's not just Juanita Brooks's papers, which, you know, I've spent the last 4 or 5 years in now, reading every scrap of document that I can in that. They have an incredible archive that's digitized. They have oral histories, and not just for Mormon history stuff or Utah history. They have computer science. I'm working on a documentary film project that has to do with the computer science department there, and It's amazing the stuff that's digitized over there. So it's the, I really think like some of the unsung heroes of history are these like college libraries who, where the archivists are digitizing the stuff. It's incredible. I think about Juanita Brooks, who in the 1940s and 1950s had to take the night bus from St. George to Salt Lake just to see one paper. And I literally could just hop on my computer and type it in and have all of these incredible scans. It's such a fun time to do history, I think.
And part of the evolution of this, too, is how information can be shared. In Juanita's time, it was frequently typescripts of things because you could at least make a mimeograph copy of it or something. But now, obviously, with the advent of scanning, this is just unbelievable. So,
well, now we're talking about AI being able to translate and transcribe journals, which is cool because all you youngsters out there are not learning cursive anymore. And those who have learned it can't read it very well. This man can read it very well. Whenever I have a cursive that I can't read, you get it down pretty well. You would have made a good third grade teacher.
Oh, man. It is sad, and it's kind of hard to argue for teaching cursive solely so that kids can read historical records.
I know, but I always tell my kids that. I'm like, how are you going to read a document? They're like, we don't care about documents.
We're not going to be doing that, Mom. We don't care. And
well, you got your kids transcribing stuff.
I've had my kids help transcribe things. It's
my
been
kids
kind
would
of fun.
Never do that. They would shoot themselves in the face before they did that.
And periodically, I'll show them different examples of like Willard Richards versus like Mike Quinn's handwriting, which is relatively easy to read. And so, yeah. It's the loss of being able to read cursive is honestly a serious problem in history.
Well, and then we have the documents that we're interested in are at a time when they were using Pittman shorthand, which I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, oh, our Pittman shorthand now are the acronyms that people use on text messages. Because I have friends send me stuff all the time and I'm like, what is KIK? Like looking it up and I'm like, that's not an acronym. What?
That doesn't mean anything. Get out of
Pittman
here.
Shorthand is another thing. And Lejean Carruth, we talked about her a lot on the podcast. She's like the preeminent translator of Pittman shorthand. And then we've got the fun thing of Desert Alphabet, which, you know, you've got a few documents in this old 19th century language that Mormons came up with, and it's kind of fun to transcribe. I can do Desert Alphabet pretty well.
That one's at least better because it's you know, it's phonetic and it's, you know, there's
a
limited
code.
Number of characters. Yeah, that one's
it's like playing
that one's a little easier at least.
So. Oh, speaking of just because we talked about this at Sunstone and you love to talk about it. Talk about codes, too, in our sources.
Oh, codes are fascinating.
Maybe we should do our own video on codes.
We could do that because we found some really interesting examples of those. There was a fascinating one on Facebook the other day. The Stephen Post Journal had these entries for Kirtland that all of a sudden he clearly slips into some sort of code. And no one had been able to figure it out. And someone posted an image of this asking for help. What's going on? Within like an hour, somebody's like, oh yeah, my roommate who does codes is like, this is probably what's going on. And boom, they figured it out.
What was it?
And it was related to the initial washing anointing ceremonies going on there.
The Kirtland anointing.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. So big, if you want to look at documents, if you want to check sources, go to the university. Some Utah Tech is digitizing stuff.
Utah Tech's got some stuff.
In fact, that's why it's slowing down my Juanita book, because my Juanita book is done, ready to go, contract signed. The U is like, where is it? But then I just found out a bunch of documents, new documents got are being transcribed, digitized at Utah Tech that her grandkids have turned in. So this book is never going to be finished.
Fun fact from those papers, her name was actually Lucille. Not many people knew that, so.
Yeah.
I want to talk about two really pretty new developments in this. And one of them, the first at Claremont, the Fernando Gomez collection that was just donated, and they're working on now cataloging and digitizing parts of that, is fascinating because this is largely a history of Mormonism in Mexico, and much of that obviously in Spanish. And so part of this effort to collect, digitize, and interpret is widening the scope of what kind of history we want to talk about.
Which we've needed so long for in the field of Mormon history for just like Scandinavian, like Danish. sources, because, you know, my ancestors are largely Scandinavian and we can't read all of their stuff because not only is it in pesky cursive, but it's in languages that, like, and letters I don't even know. So I think the technology is really going to bring out some cool stuff. And it's, that's why I say history is like this organic thing. It's constantly being shaped. And yet that doesn't mean you don't want to read a book from 20 years ago from Mike Quinn just because there's been new stuff found. I mean, my method is reading both. For the podcast, some episodes that we're recording today, I read dissertations written in the 60s, and it's full of racist language and attitudes that reflect cultural ideas at the time and some bad information, but there's so much good information too. And sometimes in the history, it becomes known at the time in that generation. And so it's just assumed it's known. So they talk about new things. And then that information needs to be rediscovered. So just because it's old and just because there's new stuff that that comes out doesn't mean you should ignore the old stuff either.
One more recent in, like, I discovered this last night recent, that's also fascinating that I wanted to bring out, is that Greg Prince donated his collection to the Mormon Studies program at the University of Virginia. And they have digitized about half of his numerous transcripts of the David O. McKay journals that he created as part of his biography. Hundreds and hundreds of pages from this amazing journal that we have, thanks to his secretary, Claire Middlemiss, who was smart enough to make two copies and keep one where it can be accessed. So that's one that I just discovered. So there are incredible initiatives all over the place. And that leads me to my point next, which is I am getting increasingly frustrated to read Mormon studies and especially Mormon history books with no new sources brought to the table. This drives me absolutely nuts, because if it's a topic that's pretty well known, it'll take me about 30 seconds to look and see whether or not you're bringing new stuff to the table. And with all of these things that are available, particularly the records of your average Mormon, that are just absolutely not being utilized properly.
And that's his pet peeve, because not everyone's an archive nerd like we are.
We got to dig. We're losing the ability and appreciation.
I don't know. We spend so much time doing it. I'll get a 2 a.m. message from Brian. You know, he found something good. If it comes at 2 a.m., it's a document. It takes me a minute. I'm like, what is the, oh, wow. He's found some good stuff lately. I'm not going to say what, but like really groundbreaking stuff.
Really fun stuff.
Like, he's going to publish a book about it, because I shouldn't tease this. Anyway, he's very good at this. My pet peeve is what you just mentioned, which is we prioritize the leadership, the white, wealthy, rich Mormon history, and we don't prioritize the other histories. I had this issue come up with talking about the Dixie Wine Mission. And the common story is that the sacrament cups that are small happened in 1918 because of the flu pandemic. It was published in the Saints. It's one of those things that we just keep regurgitating, because it's true. They come out with a standardized tray then. I had made a claim on the Salt Lake Tribune podcast about a quote for, I think it's from 1864, where Brigham Young realizes that in southern Utah, a lot of the alcoholics down there are drinking too much wine in their goblets, so he wants to make smaller cups. And so that really starts them thinking about the shape of the sacrament cups. And I got some pushback, and people are like, she doesn't know what she's talking about, because everyone knows in 1918. And I'm like, you guys, it's a yes and. Like, we have to stop. So then, of course, my sources are, you know, different varieties of cups from all over the different wards and all of the different areas, because what Brigham Young was doing and what the men were doing in 1918 doesn't mean what was happening in every single chapel, because correlation that we, the modern Mormonism that we understand now, everything is standardized, it's all made in the same factory, it's all distributed the same way. It wasn't that way in the 19th century. You were at the mercy of what the local people in your area could scrounge up as far as resources go. You were at the mercy of the knowledge of their scriptures. That's what the things that they taught in their sermons. It was very diverse. And so I really get bothered when people prioritize well, it's a record in the president's office, so that must mean it was that way for everybody. Mormonism, as we know, if you've grown up in the church, in any of the Mormon factions, is the same, but it's also different based on individual experiences. And we don't get enough of the everyday chapel Mormons. That's less prioritized than like what the institution says. And that bothers me.
So there's your state of the sources. The TLDR, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of stuff out there. And so we'll put links to a lot of these projects that are out there so you can go exploring. Because there, and that's the thing is, this is another thing we should mention again, is this Edith Romney Society project that we've talked about before, which is a project to try to help get some of this stuff transcribed and more available. Because there are all these things that are just waiting to make their way into approved history and authorized and Orthodox history, just because they need someone to make them available. And if more stuff like that is available to historians, they're more likely to use it, and our history will become richer and more complex. So we'll also put a link to that if you'd like to help with that project.
And just back to the original statement about faithful versus not faithful sources, that can be a useful tool, I guess, in seeing where people position. But again, when we're looking at documentary history, which is what, you know, largely history is right now, people lie in documents all the time. People leave out things in documents all the time. I always say, look at your own group chats and your group texts. Do you tell your mom the same story that you tell your best friend about a situation, right? It's depending on who the audience is. So it's useful when you're evaluating the sources to see where people position and how they're telling it, how they got the information, where they situate to the knowledge, and sort of root that out for yourself, because this is kind of a crazy field. It's high stakes and it matters. So we kind of are of the mindset, and we do this podcast to bring the history to more people in our community, because we think everybody should be engaged in it because it matters so much to people. So familiarize yourself with these sources. Don't be afraid of going to the archives. Brian is always, if you go into the bookshop, he's always willing to help walk people through it. Maybe I shouldn't offer that.
We have had so many tutorials on how to use online catalogs and find out what's available.
You've helped me sometimes when I can't find something he can usually find. I was trying to find the height of Charles C. Rich the other day. We still haven't.
Lyman.
No, we know Lyman.
No, other way.
Oh, wait, we got Charles Rich. Yeah. We don't know Amasa Lyman's height.
These are the kind of details that drive us nuts. That tells you a little bit about
how
us.
How tall was Amasa Lyman? We're going to find out. Anyway, I hope this wasn't too boring. It's the kind of nerdy stuff we like to talk about, but it shouldn't be seen as a sin if some source gets something wrong. It's just where they position. And it's always, you know, a goal and sort of a craft to help shape it closer to the truth or get more information. And to me, that's so exciting. It's so exciting to be able to do that, to be like sort of Indiana Jones in the bookshop and seeing how Mormons are telling the stories of our people. So, yeah, we'll throw some links in our show notes, and tell us what you think of the video. If you like the video, subscribe. We're going to do a few more of these. And of course, as always, check us out at the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast on any of your streaming platforms. Spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. Smoke sent to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young, and let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young, I have sinned so gravely, brother Young. The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.